Welcome to The Sequester.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From APM in New York, good morning. I'm Jeremy Hobson, and the dreaded sequester is finally here. Now, we've talked on this show about the effects it'll have on the Pentagon, which is facing a $50 billion budget cut. So what does that mean for the economy in places that depend on defense spending? Adam Allington reports from St. Louis Public Radio.
Defense is big business in St. Louis. Under the sequester, many of the 5,000 civilians working at nearby Scott Air Force Base are facing one day of unpaid leave every week. But is a 20% pay cut for a few thousand people really going to hurt consumer spending in a region of 2.8 million? Glenn McDonald is a professor of economics at Washington University.
I'd say the effect is likely to be fairly minimal.
McDonald says those 9% cuts at the Pentagon aren't really cuts at all. Rather, it's just curbing increases. Defense contractor Boeing is the second largest employer in the region, with a workforce of 15,000 people. But it's likely to be buffered from the immediate impacts of the sequester. Roman Schweitzer is a senior defense policy analyst at Guggenheim Securities. He says defense contracts are typically multi-year arrangements.
So the brunt of that 9% cut would be spread over the course of, anywhere from 1 to 3 to 5 years.
Which leaves plenty of time for Congress to reverse course, take money out of butter, and put it back in guns. In St. Louis, I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Well, while we're talking about the sequester, it's worth noting that this is not the first time we've had one. And if you ask the people who were involved before, you'll find the bureaucratic challenges involved in carving up the budget aren't easy to deal with. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
There have been sequesters before. Five, actually. The last time was 1991. Barry Anderson was the top civil servant at the Office of Management and Budget. He says that sequester was minuscule compared to today, but it was still a pain to carry out.
It is truly extraordinary how detailed it was.
Every discretionary government activity had to be shaved down a little, even down to maintaining lighthouse buoys in the Chesapeake Bay. Anderson says one time he got a call from a confused government employee asking him what could be cut when the only activity was scraping the bird droppings off the buoy.
And I said, well, you got to do a 2% cut. Next time you send them out, only have them clean up 98% of the bird guano. You can see the type of difficulty it is trying to implement this.
The first sequester in 1986 was big. It called for more than $10 billion in savings. That experience made Congress more sober about across-the-board cuts, says Jim Savage. He's a political science professor at the University of Virginia.
It was painful enough so that there weren't any really big sequesters after that. They always found a way to sort of get around it.
Until today. I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
And let's do the numbers. Stocks are mostly lower in global trading this morning, down 0.6% in Hong Kong, 0.8% in Frankfurt, and 0.5% right now in London. On Wall Street yesterday, the Dow lost 20 points to close at 14,054.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
There's a documentary that premieres today about hunger in America. It's called A Place at the Table, and it was put together by the chef Tom Colicchio of Top Chef fame and his wife Lori Silverbush. Well, as part of our coverage of wealth and poverty issues, we're joined now by Tom Colicchio. Good morning.
Morning.
Well, so first of all, why did you make this movie?
5-6 years ago, my wife was mentoring a young girl, and we figured out that she was often hungry and her family was often hungry. So my wife came home one day and said, I want to explore the idea of doing a film about hunger, and realized that in 1968 there was a news piece on CBS that focused on hunger, and soon after that legislation was created that pretty much wiped out hunger until the 80s in this country. And so the film or a news piece fixed it once, that we can probably fix it again.
How much of the solution to this problem is from the government? How much of it is from families? How much of it is from private businesses and organizations?
Well, I think the government is the real key here. If it was just about charity, just about money, we would have solved this already. You know, if you look at things that government has done before, and sort of health issues that they saw, like yellow fever and cholera and things like that, these were issues that we thought were just issues of the poor, issues of the inner city, and it wasn't until government figured out that it was either through mosquitoes or through water that was tainted. And that took care of these problems. But I think the problem right now is that this isn't something that has become a voting issue. I mean, if you looked at the last election, it didn't come up once.
How much do things like school lunches help?
Well, 17 million children are food insecure. You know, at some point of the month, they're going to struggle to put food on the table. So school lunch, if you figure, can really take care to feed a lot of kids who are food insecure. But again, the problem with that is, what are we feeding them? And so if you look at school lunch and you look at the dollars that are allocated to a meal, it's a dollar and change. And so it's really not enough to put healthy food on the plate for a lot of kids.
And your own mother ran a high school lunch program.
She did. She ran a high school lunch program in Elizabeth, New Jersey, where we grew up.
So were you talking about these issues as a kid then?
No, you know, not as a kid, no. You know, we always just, my brothers and I assumed that my mother was going to work and there was kind of social time for her. You know, she was just getting out of the house and doing her thing. And it wasn't until she was in her sort of 60s, late 60s, and we were trying to get her to retire. She said, you know, these kids who come into my lunchroom for breakfast and lunch, I know this is the only thing they're eating all day, and I'm really fighting to get them some healthy food, at least a choice. And I know if I leave, it's going to go away. So, it changed my complete view of what she was doing, and I never realized that she was actually had this in her mind that she was helping.
Tom Colicchio, chef whose new documentary is called A Place at the Table. It premieres today in theaters, on iTunes, and on demand. Thank you so much for coming in.
You're welcome. Thanks.
And finally, I don't know about you, but I've never actually tested a car to see if it can reach the top speed on the speedometer. But the answer, according to the AP, is it probably cannot. The Toyota Yaris, for example, says the car can hit 140 miles per hour. In fact, it can only do 109. And I wonder which AP correspondent got to do the fact-checking on that story. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. This is APM, American Public Media.